Have you seen Confessions of a Dangerous Mind?
Yeah, I own it.
Oh, okay.
Think the
Well,
first time I seen the movie, I saw it with you.
no, I never saw
I
it.
think I rented it when we were living together.
That doesn't mean anything. I was on so many drugs, like prescription ones.
Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. From Portland, Oregon, you are my co-host, Richard Wally.
And from the Los Angeles area, you are my co-host, Cassidy Robinson.
And today we're going to be reviewing The Huntsman, The Darkness, and in our Netflix homework, we're going to be reviewing the 1991 documentary, Paris is Burning. So I just got off of work. And we're doing a straight off of work show, so we'll see how this goes.
Maybe it'll be the best of your life. Maybe it'll be the worst.
You know how there's all these articles out there? Like I don't know who's kind of pushing this out there in the online blogosphere, but there's all these like kind of pseudo medical psychological blogs being published about what it's like to be an introvert rather than an extrovert, and how you know you're an introvert, or 19 things that only introverts will understand.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's just, you know, kind of your basic Daria stuff.
Sure. You're obviously an introvert.
Right. I was an introvert before it was cool. Is what I'm saying. I'm an OG intro-V. And it's been a long time since I've done customer service. The jobs I've had for the past, I guess, like 4 years have all been jobs I can do with headphones on.
Right.
Or jobs I don't have to talk to people very much. Like when I was a driver for a year and then I didn't really have a job all through grad school other than like some writing assignments and stuff that I got paid for. But I'm realizing that it is exhausting to talk to human beings all day.
Well, sometimes I think that gets exaggerated too, because I know very like extroverts who have to deal with customer service kind of jobs, and they're worn out by the end of the day because it's a job, and
right.
You have to talk to people and deal with their bullshit complaints.
Right.
So,
well, by and large, the customers that I deal with, because I work at like a mom and pop health food grocery store. It's kind of like a Trader Joe's meets a GNC,
mm-hmm.
But it's owned by, you know, this family and all their kids work there.
Is this like a Charles Manson kind of family situation? Because you work there too, or
no? I asked one of the girls that I work with, who's like the granddaughter of the owner of the store, if she's ever heard of the Source family.
Okay, right.
Because I thought like he started it in 1980. This is
you're just unsure. It might be. So it might be.
I'm like, yeah. Ask your grandpa if he ever had an Aquarian name. But no, I actually all the customers are generally pretty cool and relaxed. Like it's kind of different from the Pocatello crowd, where in fact the other day there was like a crying child. He was like whining because he didn't get something he wanted. And I was like, this is the first time I've heard this in like the 4 weeks I've been here. That's kind of actually amazing. But that's not what I wanted to talk about. What I wanted to talk about is that the engineering that goes into customer service has changed a lot since the last time I've been doing it. There's things that's going on now. It's science fiction. I don't even understand it.
Are you talking about chips?
That's chip not... readers, chips, this is all going on. Did you know that
this is science fiction? Okay, go on.
Right, that we're living in the Left Behind universe now, apparently. Everybody asks if we have a chip reader, and of course I have to tell them no, because they haven't upgraded it yet. But this happened, and I thought, this is strange. The other day, somebody went to go pay, and instead of just using their credit card, they, like, took out their smartphone and then, like, put it next to the slider, and it just, like, went boop, 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 and it did it. Huh? I don't even know what the hell just happened.
Cassidy, welcome to a brave new world of technology that we all own in our pockets. Well, I can't make fun of you too much. I'm just as bad sometimes. Sometimes listening to the backstage kind of stuff between us with technology, I don't feel... We're definitely older millennials, not younger millennials, because some of the stuff say is stupid.
I mean, I live in West LA, so everybody besides me is rich.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the people who are using this stuff or asking about it are, like, you know, in their, like, 30s to 50s. In general, the store kind of skews older. But, yeah, I don't know. I didn't even know what happened. It was like he, like, did a Patronus spell on the slider.
I can't even take you seriously right now. Yeah, that's the thing that exists, Cassidy.
Can you explain it to me? Why does the phone know to do that?
It's a digital signal. And I mean, basically all it's doing is your phone. There's an app on my phone. I could do it too. I just am too lazy and haven't set it up. But you basically, yeah, it takes it straight from your bank account. It's like any of your cards or anything like that. You just point it at it and it sends a digital signal, and you don't even need to swipe your card through it.
But how does the slider know to communicate with your phone? They're two different types of technology.
It's all out there, man. Made you know, you remember that scene in Heat? Where it's just like a 5-minute scene that they're talking to the guy in the wheelchair, and he's like, there's just all these things floating in the air. It's like that, Cassidy. There's just these things floating in the air, and it just transfers right on over.
I don't get it.
Okay, that's a legitimate one. The chip reader, I was like, okay, whatever. But then you brought up that one. It is kind of cool. I don't use it because I'm just like, okay, is this first generation technology that you're going to like try to use it 15 times and it's going to break down and then you're going to have to just break out your credit cards anyways. So right. I've seen other people use it in stores though. And I'm like, oh, it does work. Okay. That's good.
Yeah. People trade Pokemon that way now.
Had they been doing it for a while. It's just like that. Yeah. Cassidy, like when we had our little DSs.
But those were the same technology. Okay. I'm over it. Have you done anything cool?
No, this was a quiet week after my big adventure.
Last week, yeah. Let's go ahead and get into the movie news. I'm going to start with this one. This is hot off the presses, hot off the ones and zeros. Kevin Smith is making an Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai TV show. And I'm reading this off of IO9. It says, the series based on the wonderfully weird 1984 cult science fiction classic, The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension, is likely coming to TV courtesy of Kevin Smith, and we, IO9, have Flash to thank, or blame, depending on your point of view. The source of this unholy tidbit is Smith himself, who said on a recent installment of his podcast that his directorial stint on The Flash was such a slam dunk that it opened new doors all over Hollywood. One of those doors was MGM, a studio that found great success turning Fargo into a TV series. There, Smith was invited to discuss the possibilities of doing the same with Buckaroo Banzai. His idea, and they quote him, basically you just do the entire movie for one season. Then season two, you finally do the sequel we've all been dreaming about. So we reviewed Buckaroo Banzai in our Netflix homework a long time ago.
Correct.
I'm not sure if Buckaroo Banzai is still on Netflix. It might be. But one of the criticisms I said of it was it's entertaining and it has a lot of personality and it has a really cool cast. Peter Weller was RoboCop was the lead character. And I think a really young Jeff Goldblum was in there as well.
He was a cowboy.
Yes. But I said it's just kind of a lot of stuff happening. The mythology is so dense and it sort of just drops you in the middle of everything that's going on in this world that it feels like you're watching like a 3 episodes of a television series where you're not seeing all of the stuff that came before it. So in a way, I think this is a great property to turn into a TV series, more so even than Fargo, which I think is a very singular, you know, auteur movie. But
I hear good things about that.
Yeah, everyone says it's the best show ever. I'm willing to take a look at it. It has a great cast.
When will you do that?
Probably never, but it's on the list of shows I want to watch, but never will. But yeah, so I'm kind of into this, and you know, maybe television is where Kevin Smith can kind of find his sea legs again. What's his movie that's coming out this year? The spinoff of Tusk, Yoga Hosers.
Yoga Hosers, yes.
About the two girls that work at the convenience store.
Yeah, it's basically Clerks, but set in Canada, apparently.
Yeah, and I think the Johnny Depp character comes back and plays a bigger role.
Well, I do know that the two girls in that, one is his daughter and the other one is...
Kevin Smith's daughter, yeah.
Well, one is Kevin Smith's and one is Johnny Depp's daughter, yeah.
Right, right.
So that's a thing.
That's a thing that's happening. And it already played at Sundance to not very strong reviews, but maybe television is where he can kind of get a little bit more comfortable again. Maybe having that kind of strict deadline and not being able to just do whatever the hell he wants is maybe good for him at this stage. I don't know. But I and Buckaroo Banzai is weird enough that he could have fun with it and put his personality into it. But yeah, what do you think?
No, I mean, there's a big pulpy sensibility to the whole thing anyway. So
right.
I think that Kevin Smith would be a good fit to it. Even some of the other stuff, I was half and half about Tusk. The reason I'm not sold on Yoga Hoosers is basically because the reason I didn't like Tusk was because of the Johnny Depp character. So, but I could see going into this, there being all those weird idiosyncratic stuff going on that, you know, fitting in a horror movie with a walrus person being just kind of another, you know, bump in the road when it comes to Buckaroo Banzai. So yeah, I think that this would be a good thing for him. Also, I think it'd be good to have a writing staff, kind of a new and just kind of do something different. You know, maybe right. Film isn't just his muse right now, and he needs to do it in a different medium that kind of operates differently.
And being able to like bounce ideas off of other people and have, you know, sort of a filtration system before his ideas end up on the screen.
So I think that this is a good move, and I'm not totally against Kevin Smith at this point. I'll even probably give Yoga Hoosers a shot.
Sure. Yeah.
But this sounds more promising to me than any of his films have, even though I really liked Red State. So.
Right. What was your story?
My story is about that little independent company, Marvel. It's a French company, I believe. They make superhero films that nobody watches ever.
Avant-garde superhero movies.
Yeah, right, right.
Yeah, very niche.
One of the ones that we know is coming in the future, there's no surprises there anymore, is Black Panther. We already know that Chadwick Boseman is going to be playing the lead in that. But they're starting to fill out the other actors, and Ryan Coogler, I think I got the right one.
Yeah.
Ryan Coogler from Fruitvale Station and
Creed.
Mm-hmm. He signed up to direct this. So it's a pretty impressive just cast. Ryan Coogler also said about this movie that he says he wants to try to make it one of his most personal movies yet, which is sort of interesting. It's like, oh, okay, we'll see how this goes. But some of the names they're bringing up on is Lupita Nyong'o.
Yeah.
Lupita Nyong'o. Sorry about that.
Right. From 12 Years a Slave.
Yeah. She's one of the names that they've been talking about. Where she comes in, that's not really said clearly. And the other one that they just announced, which is probably a good shoe-in, is Michael B. Jordan. I think he's an amazingly charismatic actor and really quite, I mean, just really quite great. But something that actually they're talking about is he might be the villain. And that appeals to me a lot because that charisma and I think he can do that darker tone, especially from Fruitvale Station. And I would like to see him do something a little bit different in.
He's a pretty likable guy.
Yeah. Oh, I think he's got a baby face.
He's not exactly, but he could almost he has kind of the vibe of like, I guess, kind of like a Tom Hanks type. Or a young Denzel. But Denzel did Malcolm X, and Denzel did Training Day. So he was, he could play a son of a bitch when he needed to.
Yeah, and I think Michael B. Jordan can as well. In Fruitvale Station, there were moments where he was very likable, but then there were moments where you saw the more violent and maybe not necessarily a copacetic person that other films would probably present. They showed him as being kind of, he's somebody that's recovering from being a criminal.
Right.
In Fruitvale Station. So to see him go full bad guy, no, I would like that. And to be honest, I don't think being charismatic is a bad thing for your bad guy. No, I think that's one of the best things for a bad guy is for them to be charismatic. Because if you can really love to hate somebody, that's what makes, I think, some of the best villains, at least in cinema. So,
sure. And, I think the only question I have as far as this goes is Michael B. Jordan just came off of the terrible failure that was the Fantastic Four reboot.
Mm-hmm.
And do you think people still have a bad enough taste in their mouth from that it could carry over to the marketing of this movie? Or do you think that, like, Civil War gave a runway to the marketing campaign for Black Panther?
Oh, yeah. The latter. Civil Wars, it did paint a very clear picture and a very clear line right to Black Panther. So
right.
I'm not too worried about that. Also, Marvel Studios has, whether you like them or not, whether you think they're too like campy or silly, or they're just not, they're just too lighthearted for you, whether you think that or not, they have a good track record. They know how, and Disney knows how to market. So
right. This will also be the second time that they've stole two human torches and turned them into something else.
Yeah. Well, see, they've got a good track record with human torches too. So I wouldn't be, there's not too much to despair about there. So no, yeah. I think it's good. What's your next article?
Okay. This one's kind of interesting. Lars von Trier is setting up a serial killer thriller that he wants to start shooting in August called The House That Jack Built. And, I read the article off of Birth, Movies, Death, and I told you they have a penchant for kind of writing jokey news articles.
Mm-hmm.
They make fun of him as, like, basically he's the dark guy. All of his movies are super dark, and he's just going to make another dark movie.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the coolest idea about this is it says it's set in Washington and revolves around a serial killer, and the story is going to be told from the killer's perspective and takes place over 10 to 12 years. So that, I think, is a really cool idea. There's been a lot of serial killer thrillers and a lot of, like, procedural kind of post Silence of the Lambs 7 kind of stuff about, like, a specific case, but nobody has ever done a serial killer movie that takes place over a long span of time, because there are a lot of serial killers, or have been a lot of serial killers, that have been able to operate for many years and never been caught.
I don't know. There's all those, when you said that, the first thing came to mind, I was thinking of those Bundy and Dahmer movies, those, like,
well,
direct to, like, DVD. Those took over place over many years.
Yeah, that was.
I know. I'm not trying to take away. That was just what first came to my mind. I apologize for derailing you, but that was my first thought.
Yes, TV movies notwithstanding. But, the cool thing about Lars von Trier and his style is he generally does that thing in the chapters.
Right.
He's super into that. And the way that they described it here in the article is that it's going to be sort of structured like Nymphomaniac, where you go over different periods of the person's life.
Hmm.
And there'll be these kind of, connected but somewhat disconnected vignettes in that Lars von Trier sort of way.
Right.
And really, he got that, like, from Kubrick and Pasolini and a bunch of other people. But, yeah, I think the idea is cool. And, we've seen Antichrist. We know he can do horror to some extent. And even when he makes, like, dramas are kind of horror. Even when he makes comedies are kind of horror.
You're like, something bad's going to happen.
Yeah.
Usually something bad does happen. It's just, what on the scale of bad?
At some point you're going to be deeply unsettled and uncomfortable by his
movies. Planets colliding, or our weddings ending, or penises being lopped off and swung at people's faces or anything like that. We don't know. But with a serial killer thriller, I think you'd have to kind of weigh also, like, he's going to bring an artistic value to that.
Like, yeah, whether, it's going to look great.
Whether
you know that
you've
much.
Liked his last films for those sort of things or not, is that's up to you. But I mean, he always tries to bring something to what he does. I can say that about him.
So. Right. He's an, you know, whether or not you agree with his ideas or whether or not you think he even agrees with his own ideas, he's always wrestling with them. Mm-hmm. And sometimes he like confuses them, or sometimes he sort of like will subvert them so much to the point that it sounds like he's contradicting himself. But that's part of the reason you watch his movies, is there's thematically always something interesting going on, and his movies always look terrific. And you know he's not going to skimp on the content. He's not going to gloss it up.
No, he will go there.
It's gonna go there.
Yeah. No, yeah. In that sense, again, I'm at least, it perks my interest. Like, if this was going to be another, I don't know, three movies worth of like girls need to have sex, I don't know, and then it just be a boring, I don't know. Nymphomaniac, I didn't really care for much. It was kind of a boring slog for me, to be honest. Mm. But this, in a self-contained movie, I don't know. Then I kind of go back and I wrestle, because I'm like, okay, Antichrist, even though it scarred me, was good. Dogville was really good. Melancholia was somewhere in the middle for me. So his sense of... this kind of makes sense to me, him making this film. What he's going to do and say with it is another, that's a question mark. Is he going to really just be like, oh, I'm making a serial killer movie? Or is he making some other statement through it, like about his emerging sexuality as a teenager or something like that?
Well, possibly. But I mean, I think that all of that could only make it better, because we've already seen enough schlocky, you know, serial killer pulp dime novel stuff. I'm interested in his take.
Sure. No,
whatever it is.
No, I agree. I mean, that's the thing though, is he could be making a movie, I don't know, about butterflies using scissors to create grass people. I don't know. That's what came out of my head. Sorry. I apologize. He could be making that, and I would check it out just because I'm like, well, he is at least somewhat interesting. He makes a mess sometimes, but at least it's a somewhat interesting mess. So
yeah, his movies are always, always start discussion.
Yes.
No matter what. Okay, so that's the movie news for this week. Let's go ahead and get into our reviews, and I'm going to let you review The Huntsman, because I didn't see it.
Right. The Huntsman, I saw that, like, I guess I always have to put this disclaimer, because when I see a movie 3 weeks ago and it didn't really impact me, that I'm like, okay, bear with me. Got to get my thoughts together here. But it's a pretty simple film. If you saw the last one and you were a fan of it, this, I would say, is close to that-ish. I don't think it's as good visually. I think the last movie actually was a prettier film. But this movie is a little bit more streamlined in the sense that it has a sense of humor to it. They just blatantly got rid of the Snow White character. They're like, oh, people don't like that Kristen Stewart anymore. We're throwing her away. But we still got Chris Hemsworth, so we're going to make a film. And we've got Charlize Theron. Why don't we throw some Emily Blunt in there and some Jessica Chastain? Now, to me, actually, I like hear that and I'm like, wow, that's actually a really great cast. They're mostly misused. I will say that Charlize Theron, she still tries to chew up the scenery. It's not as impressive because
we've seen it.
We've seen it. Emily Blunt, I actually didn't think did too much. I love Emily Blunt. She was okay. She wasn't appalling by any means. Jessica Chastain, on the other hand, she was pretty badass. She played a female huntsman, and she did like the action scenes and stuff like that. And she looked really good and believable doing it.
Okay.
She's a classy dame, and no one should ever disparage her. Chris Hemsworth was kind of fun, but what's interesting is the Jessica Chastain and Chris Hemsworth character, they both did this like, I don't know, maybe this existed in the last one and I just didn't catch on, but they're doing this like Scottish brogue, and it was somewhat distracting. What they added to this is they added some humor through some like dwarf characters. Actually one of them, I think it's Alexander Roach. I could be wrong on that, but anyways, she kind of still stole the show. She was super funny and really added something to watch while you're watching this kind of schlog of a movie. It's not very good. If you're a fan of these actors, I mean, I guess, or this like postmodern retellings, adult action adventure fairy tale movies, I guess you can go watch them. to me, it's sort of like maybe certain people trying to watch superhero films that aren't into them. I just don't get it. I'm just like, okay, cool. So this is like them trying to do like a more adult, but not going all the way there version of a Disney film. Cool, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
The story is more streamlined than the first one, but the images don't actually, like, one thing that I liked about the first one a little bit more than this one is I don't think you could look at it and say it's an ugly film. Fantastical things happening and it looked good. This film did that at times, but most of the time you could tell that they spent their money on their actors as opposed to anything else. Some of the CG looked kind of like it came from 5 years ago and it just wasn't. I can't really say, I feel snarky, but this is what I have to say about the film. It wasn't very good. If you absolutely love the actors, then maybe it's entertaining for like maybe to catch it on Netflix.
Okay.
But right. I wouldn't say go run out and watch it, which I don't think a lot of people did anyways. So
yeah, you're probably right. Okay. Yeah. That's kind of what I thought. And just in case anybody cares, the actual title is Huntsman Winter's War. So, and I doubt that was an accident.
No, they were clearly...
They were trying to draw some sort of parallel between the fact that this has a Marvel actor in it and a very recent popular movie was called Winter Soldier.
Oh, I was saying, I thought more... what I saw more than anything was them to try to direct parallel between this and Frozen.
Oh, yeah, possibly that, and possibly Game of Thrones.
There's a sister thing going on in there between Charlize Theron and Emily Blunt. It happens.
Frozen-ish.
It's Frozen-ish, and I mean, Emily Blunt's character is very Frozen-ish. She has long white hair and can control frost and do stuff with elemental... winter powers. So
yeah, see, that I think that's why I didn't see it, and why I think, you know, most of what I've heard about it is bad. It just seems like it seems like it should be an episode of ABC's Once, not a movie.
It sort of is, but they've expanded it into a movie and got really good, you know, the actors I don't think actually come off looking that bad. It's just kind of a lackluster film. This isn't going to like offend anybody, but it's just kind of like, okay, I watched it. Again, the dwarfs are sometimes funny.
I recall they were the best part of the first one too, but I don't remember that movie hardly at all. Okay, let's go ahead and get into our main review, which is another movie I don't think a lot of people are going to watch. A little horror film from Blumhouse called The Darkness. And I know you're immediately thinking of the early to mid 2000s joke metal band.
That's all I got.
Yeah.
I don't even know what they say. I just hear noises. You had to do it. I love it. Yeah. You loved it. Everyone loved it. Don't pretend. Don't be a hater.
This is directed by, so the reason why I wanted to review this movie specifically, other than the fact that we've just had extremely slim pickings for the week, was it was directed by Greg McLean, who directed a horror film, an Aussie horror film, around like 2005, 2006 called, Wolf Creek that I liked a lot. And it came out actually like a week before Hostel. And I think, it always sort of got lumped into that that torture porn sort of category, like when people were first starting to write articles about like this whatever movement in the horror film.
Splat Pack.
Yeah, that movie always gets name dropped as being sort of a kissing cousin to movies like Devil's Rejects and and Saw and Hostel, but I always thought of Saw it much more in the tradition of other exploitation, kind of bleak, atmospheric horror films where it's all about sort of the atmosphere and all about sort of the landscape playing a big part of it.
I think people with superficial knowledge of horror, I think it makes sense. It does have elements of torture porn. It is an extreme horror, but
yes.
But I specifically, I don't see torture porn. To me, it was being turned from like somebody just labeling something to a pejorative, and that's where it gets fuzzy. I don't necessarily. I think it is technically in that kind of body of stuff of extreme horror, but I don't think that it necessarily. I think it hits more categories for different kinds of horror fans because it does kind of harken back to like Texas Chainsaw and a lot of those. And it was a fantastic film. And we should talk about that film a lot more on this podcast, Wolf Creek, than we should the film that he...
That we're talking about. And I think the fact that we're not maybe speaks volumes.
Yes.
Okay, so this movie is...
Not about the metal band.
Not about the metal band. This movie is about a suburban family, dysfunctional family. Kevin Bacon and Jennifer Morrison play the mother and father. And they have a few kids, a teenage daughter, and I guess sort of preteen son who has autism or is autistic. You don't have autism. And they go on a trip to the Grand Canyon and they're kind of hiking around. This boy falls into a cavern and finds these mysterious stones with these kind of Native American sort of carvings on it, and he takes it home. And in the grand tradition of haunted house horror films, you don't bring weird totems that you find out in the wilderness back home.
You collect them in a room in a vault in your house.
Yes. And then, of course, once we leave the Grand Canyon sort of prologue, they go home and all these weird things start happening, both sort of internally within the family and the attitudes of the family members. They all start to revert back to their, I guess, their least savory personality traits. The daughter becomes bulimic. The boy just in general is becoming stranger and stranger, and that's a little hard to gauge because he's autistic. So, you know, what's normal, strange, and what's bad, strange. And that might be the most interesting idea the movie has and does nothing with. And Kevin Bacon is thinking about cheating and blah, 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 blah. And then, of course, the supernatural weird stuff starts happening that we've seen in all of these Blumhouse specials, including weird smells, shadowy things, faucets turning on unexplained, and sounds, and being attacked by wolves in the middle of the night. What did you think of The Darkness? Or do I really have to ask?
You don't, but I'll answer your question. this is a Blumhouse movie by the numbers, and that's not a good thing.
Yeah, I don't necessarily say it's a Blumhouse movie in a pejorative way, except for this time.
Exactly, because this is like taking anything. There are a lot of good Blumhouse productions, sure. And I think that the way that they make things is interesting. Is they try to do it low, cost efficient horror, and I think that's not. I think that to try to spark creativity and also not to continue this, we need a bazillion dollars to make a movie kind of idea. Yeah. I think that's a really cool.
They're really the new Lionsgate.
Right.
Like back in the day, Lionsgate sort of did these movies. They would do these low to mid budget horror flicks and make a ton back on them because you don't need stars to sell them and you're just selling on a concept. And Lionsgate used to be the kings of that. And then they made actual money. They made, you know, big boy money with those Hunger Game movies, those Hunger Games. And now they're in the big leagues now, competing with the Marvels and whatever. But very much Jason Blum and the way he's running the studio is reminds me a lot of a Dimension or a early Lionsgate.
Sure. Again, talking about other things other than the movie.
Other than the movie.
The movie, yeah. If you've seen a ghost movie, this is that. And it's the most boring and tepid version of it. what was weird to me is maybe the most offensive thing in it was the score. I found it very divisive, and I noticed it all the time. All the time I was like, they're trying to tell me something, and this has the weirdest tone. There are times where I was like, there shouldn't be any music. This would be better if there was no sounds whatsoever. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot... None of the actors come across necessarily bad, but they don't come across necessarily good. Mm-hmm. They just come across as boring.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing about this film is it's not... It's just so dismal. And I don't like to come on here and be kind of like mean to things, but this is not well done. And it makes me question, is this one of those situations where like a foreign director comes into American studio and doesn't understand the ropes and just kind of puts out a not very good movie? I kind of want to say yes.
But you would think with a studio like this that he would kind of, it's not like he's like being brought in to make Captain America 4.
Sure.
You know, or like Star Trek 7 or something.
Well,
like
yeah,
that.
But there's even, but I mean, you could even say that with like the, not Wachowskis, the Weinstein brothers. When they brought in directors, it should have been a plug-in and not a very hard one. Because what they were doing is they're bringing him to make a foreign film or just a very simple like family drama. But then they'd bring in these foreign directors and they'd still make these kind of stupid projects. And you'd be like, what the hell? How did that mess up? So right. I think sometimes there is something that's weird about the politics or the financing or whatever of a film that you know, they just have a certain freedom that they lacked. In that they got in that maybe Greg McLean got in Australia versus he got in the States, there might just be a difference there.
He also, if I'm not mistaken, and I'll double check in case I am, he hasn't really made anything in a while.
He made an alligator movie, I think called Rogue, that came out after Wolf Creek, and he made Wolf Creek 2. Wolf Creek 2 was. The first Wolf Creek was a very serious film. The second film was very jokey. And it was kind of like mocking people who are like, oh, this is so Australia because it's so hard. And it's literally like there's a scene where there's a truck and it hits like kangaroos and it makes them explode. And he makes fun of that Aussie exploitation kind of title with the second film.
Okay.
So it's sort of... he's made a couple of films here and there. I also believe there's a Wolf Creek TV series in Australia. There's lots of Wolf Creek stuff happening, but this might not just be his thing because besides the studio system, maybe I'm not letting him off the hook completely. But what I'm saying is that you put him in this kind of guy in a PG-13 setting, you put him in a Blumhouse in another country that maybe he's not familiar with how the studio system works. Because when you got to that last act and you get into some of the weird, like Native American, like pseudo Native American, like supernatural stuff, some of that stuff looked good.
Well, okay. I'll say this about the last act of the movie. That's it's the most cinematic thing that happens in the entire movie because at least something is happening.
Right.
Even if it's just basically the ending of the Poltergeist with the new skin put on it.
Agreed.
I mean, it's this house is clear.
Yeah.
Like, it's the same fucking thing. But at least
With magical autistic kids and magical Latinos.
I mean, maybe, I don't know if you want to commend it for it or not, but it's definitely not PC.
I don't think you want to do either because I don't think it's not like deliberately offensive, but it's just sort of like.
If it was, that would be interesting.
That's true.
Like, here's my deal with the movie. The movie is so conceptually lazy and cynical. It is literally like just a boardroom of people who are like, okay, this worked in that movie. This worked in that movie. This worked in that movie. We'll just kind of plug it together. Who's kind of big, but we can still afford. Kevin Bacon wants to work with us again because he was in the first Purge. Let's put him in. Oh, no, that wasn't Kevin Bacon. That was
Ethan Hunt.
That was Ethan Hawke. I always get those two confused for whatever reason. But yeah, let's put in Kevin Bacon. Then we can get whoever the fuck to play the family because it doesn't matter. it's so conceptually lazy that to even criticize it, I feel, is like giving it too much credit as a movie. It's not even trying at the most basic levels.
It feels like Poltergeist stripped of everything you like about Poltergeist.
Yeah, Poltergeist without all of the interesting family dynamics and without any kind of metaphor or without any kind of
style. Different
sort of style or special effect that we've never seen or the Spielbergian influence or anything.
Mm-hmm.
The two ideas it has that's vaguely interesting or that they could have done something with that kind of gives it an edge is which I've already mentioned, the fact that the main character who's dealing with the ghost, because basically all these movies sort of run the same way. A kid comes in, I have a new imaginary friend, ha ha ha. Well, he's probably hungry too. And then eventually it's like, your imaginary friend's getting too weird. So, but this time around, the kid's autistic. So like I said, he already has tics and he already has kind of strange things that parents have learned to sort of ignore or to sort of go with or to placate. That conceptually is sort of an interesting idea, and you could play around with that. You could do a lot with that. They don't at all.
Agreed.
And then on top of it, the kid that got to play this, we're supposed to believe he's getting weirder and weirder, and the things he's saying and doing are so creepy now versus, you know, I guess before the movie started. But they hire the most, like, bland TV-looking actor to play this kid who clearly has...
He is Bruce Wayne in Gotham, the TV show. I don't watch it, but...
Well, I don't watch it, and now maybe I feel good that I don't. He looks like he came right off of Hotel for Dogs or something. Like, he's just the most bland, like talent agency kid you've ever seen in a movie. And like, if you're gonna do a horror movie about a creepy kid, find a fucking creepy looking kid who can like deliver a line creepily. So there's that.
Well, to be fair though, to the kid, because I have seen him in Gotham.
To work with.
Yeah, we know that Kevin Bacon, and we know that the mother, Rahita Michelle, is that her name?
Yes. Rita Michelle, yeah, she's in things.
I've seen her in other things, and both of them can act. I know they can.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, again, going a little bit ago, Kevin Bacon in Cop Car was very, very good in that film.
No, Kevin Bacon has been good recently in things. I was really surprised to see him slum it this big, but Blumhouse is kind of a name in Hollywood, and I think, you know, what if I'm in the next Conjuring? Well, he isn't.
He definitely won't be after this. But you can also notice that the studio, because I mean, how much, I mean, did you see any like previews for this or anything really?
No. And I think I saw one preview for it when I saw Green Room. They showed a lot of horror stuff beforehand because they'll do that. They'll kind of try and have the previews match the movie a little.
Sure.
Or sell to the same audience.
Makes sense.
And I remember I saw like four trailers in a row for Blumhouse movies, and they were all basically the same, including the new Conjuring that's coming up. But mm-hmm. it looked like literally the same story being told four different ways. And that's, you know, it's what they do. Some are better than others. I'm not necessarily at this point convinced that Blumhouse makes great movies so much as James Wan makes great movies.
James Wan. I liked the Purge films. We will never discuss another one of those actually on the podcast, because I don't think our friendship could take it.
Oh, but election year is coming up.
But I don't think we should watch it.
At this point, I think I'm kind of hate watching them.
I don't think we should. Every time we've done it, we've argued, and not in a pleasant way. I don't think we should do it to our friendship, Cassidy. I'm just saying.
We should bring in a third party for it. like to moderate or to mediate. But
I don't know if we could get somebody biased or unbiased enough.
Right.
But
the other thing I was going to say, the only other idea that it has is the Native American approach, right? So, but again, it shoves us right back into the suburbs, and then it plays so... It's so minimal, like you can tell they're really like cutting their corners or trying to spend as least as possible. They shove in a few special effects at the end, and that's fine. I don't necessarily have to see the monster all the time, but that was the place where you could put a lot of style into it. Or if it had taken place like at the Grand Canyon setting the whole time. I thought it was going to be The Hills Have Ghosts when it first started.
I did too. I was kind of like, oh, we'll see how this goes.
Yeah, I thought that could have been vaguely interesting. Again, it decides not to do that. But and it's shot like in the middle of Hollywood. I can see the hills right behind their house.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. This is just, it's like I said, to even criticize it, I feel, is giving it too much credence as a movie.
It's pretty...
It's just nothing. It's just, it's ephemeral. It's like a rice cracker of a movie.
Yeah, it's Blumhouse.
It's the opposite of scary.
It's boring. yeah, it's hard. Again, I don't like to necessarily get too mean about things. I mean, once in a while you have to get snarky, but this is not good. This is a very boring, not good film. I can't really recommend it at all or to anyone.
A lot of it was, the dialogue was so bad sometimes.
Just watch Poltergeist, kids.
Well, definitely just watch Poltergeist. But there was a scene, and it should have been one of those scenes where it's like, okay, you can actually inform your characters a little bit. Where Paul Reiser, for whatever reason, is in this movie.
I kind of enjoyed him. I forgot about that. I did enjoy Paul Reiser in this film, that's one more positive on my list.
He's the only person in this movie who knows what movie he's in.
Agreed.
But I don't know if it saves it. But there's a scene where he comes into, because he plays this kind of sexist blowhard boss of
Kevin Bacon,
and he comes in, and it's like the dialogue is so simplistic and so bad, and you can tell that the people who wrote it did absolutely no research in what these people do for careers.
Sure.
That it's actually kind of funny. He comes in, he's like, I've been looking at the numbers and you're under 10%. What gives? He's like, oh, you know, this job is stickier than usual.
Right. No, it's pretty bad, but I don't know, for whatever reason, he's giving like 110%, and maybe it's because he's the only character that has any energy in the film.
It's the only levity of the movie.
Yeah, yeah. That you're just like, oh, thank you, Paul Reiser, for existing. I did enjoy it. No, it doesn't save the movie in any sort of way, but you see that character and you at least go, there's something. There's some energy there. Go Paul Reiser. And then he goes away and you're like, oh yeah, we're...
Well, at that point in the movie, you're paddling for a life raft.
I also thought that the teenage daughter, her like little B story that goes on in it, could have been developed into something, but
Happens. They reveal it pretty early on, and I guess it's supposed to be kind of disturbing or gross, but it also makes absolutely no sense. Like, she's like, spoiler alert, she's saving like all these like receptacles full of her vomit under her bed. It's like, okay, so you went bulimic, but also, what the hell? Why don't you just use a bathroom like a normal human being?
Well, she also, I mean, you can obviously also see that she has a...
body issues or...
Well, no. She has a bathroom attached to her bedroom.
Yeah. Okay.
That was my problem. I was like, but she has a... Like, okay, so if you're like younger, you were like 12 or 13, you didn't have a bathroom and you didn't want to draw attention.
Mm.
That is a way that people hide, things from their parents,
right? And
specifically like people who have body images or body weight image issues and stuff like that, they do that's actually something that they that's like a pretty common knowledge for people with anorexia and bulimia. However, she has a bathroom attached and she's like 17. It's a little harder for me to buy. I'm just like, okay.
And they kind of bring it up with no sort of background to that at all. And then it kind of just goes away. And yeah.
Well, but it has these weird moments of intensity. And I'm not saying that her approach is goodness, but I'm like, there's
intensity or melodrama. Because a lot of this felt like a Lifetime movie.
A little bit of both. I mean, really, it was hard to tell because I felt like there were times that the director could not give a shit. And then there were times where it was just one like 5 minute scene where it was like, okay, now we're going to give a shit for 5 seconds.
Right.
And so it's not a good movie, but if we have to talk about it, I might as well point out that I wouldn't I will be hesitant going into Greg McLean movies from now on, but I won't necessarily like just throw it away completely, because this is one of those things where it's like,
it might not be his fault, and like, who knows the story behind the movie? And yeah, like, I don't necessarily say like
how much time did they have, like,
right, what was the budget? Like, there's a lot of things that go into this, and honestly, I think most of the problems stem from a terrible screenplay that he didn't have that much to do with.
Well, so, he is one of the people listed with two other writers, though. So
right, I mean, he's credited with, yeah.
Well, is this one that maybe the studio took away, or like,
who knows?
Yeah, it's hard to tell at this point, and it really feels swept under the rug. Blumhouse usually tries to put their films out there saying, look, we're doing something.
Yeah, they usually try and actually compete. There's a few, like there was that movie Dark Skies, which is one of the other ones I've seen. They kind of buried Sinister too. Like, I think they knew they had a turkey there. So I think there's times when they're like, this is a programmer, we'll just shove it in like the week after
we've made
Marvel
it.
Movie.
We might as well see if we can make $5 off of it.
Right.
But, well, kids, go watch Poltergeist, the original one. I have to say that. Don't watch this film.
No, I can't really recommend it at all. Unless, no, never mind.
Yeah, just stop. Usually, we try to give like a little bit of like leeway and like, these are our opinions, but for this film, it's really not going to happen.
No, I'm afraid to say. Do go see Wolf Creek, though. I mean, if you haven't yet and you want to see an actually kind of scary and I think vaguely artfully made movie, Wolf Creek is worth talking about, well, and is a kind of a highlight of horror in the mid-2000s.
Well, when we were talking about Wolf Creek is great. Definitely go see that if you do like Texas Chainsaw, you kind of like
extreme
some of the
horror.
If you like extreme horror, even some of the torture porn stuff, like more like the High Tension, like that kind of film, then yeah, check this out. Check out Wolf Creek. However, Wolf Creek 2 is a little bit more, I'm more, I guess, talking to you than the audience right now. But Wolf Creek 2 is a little bit more like, if you do watch it ever, it's a little bit more like Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Chainsaw Part 2. That's what it sounds like to me. Yeah. Or like what Tom Six did with the last Human Centipede movie.
Yeah, it just very much, he kind of, again, that Aussie exploitation.
Gremlins too, or like that kind of thing. The postmodern sort of making fun of your first movie kind of thing.
That is exactly what it does. And again, it really is like, yes, this is an Australia film, bitches. Like, it doesn't even
make any bones about that.
Well, it kind of makes fun of like certain viewers for it too, which I thought was... I at first when I watched it, I was like, I'm not sure. And then I came away and I was like, a little bit later, I was like, no, I liked that.
Right. Let's go ahead and get into our Netflix homework, which I assigned you last week, the Jenny Livingston's 1991 documentary, Paris is Burning. Do you want to describe what this movie's about?
This is a documentary about the 1980s like drag queen scene. I should say black drag queen scene.
Black and Latino, yeah.
Black and Latino, okay. It reminded me a lot of that Earl Morris one we watched. Vernon,
Texas?
No, Vernon... No,
Florida.
Florida, there we go. Vernon, Florida. It interviews and introduces you to various, like, colorful characters from that scene and what... who they are and why they do the thing they do. It reminds me of that type of documentaries from that time period. It was fun. They certainly were enjoying themselves, and so I enjoyed watching them. It kind of, to me, highlighted a lot of how things have changed in a lot of ways. But I guess the best part about it was seeing like the real hopes and desires of these people and kind of how they really do feel about being one, gay, and two, black, and having those two things together, kind of intensifying them being minorities. So I found it interesting in how they had to make these like self-made families. That is pretty much what I got out of it. this is, but it sounded like this was like one of your, like you really love this film. What is it that you really love about this film?
A lot of things. I think, you are correct in that, like Vernon Florida and like a lot of Errol Morris documentaries, sort of documentaries from this time, it puts a magnifying glass on a subculture that people at the time knew nothing about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this was a niche within a niche within a niche. And I think that, you know, when we think of the drag culture, drag queen culture, you know, in a post RuPaul world,
mm-hmm.
Now it's kind of mainstream. Absolutely. And a lot of the stuff that this movie talks about, especially a lot of the lingo and that kind of stuff.
Voguing.
Voguing is already, like, Madonna completely stole it.
Shading.
throwing shade and those kind of terms. And a lot of the stuff that came from this movie has kind of become part of the regular vernacular now, even by, quote-unquote, straight world. But what I think is really interesting about this is when people think of drag queens generally, they kind of think of, you know, these big outlandish, female impersonators who do like either lip syncing to Madonna songs or Cher or something, or doing kind of insult comic work.
Mm-hmm.
This is nothing like that. This is what I think is really, really interesting about this movie is specifically not necessarily what it's talking about just to be gay in 1991 when the movie was made. But I think there's a host of stuff to talk about during that time, but also specifically what it's kind of talking about in terms of being a low income minority during the Reagan era. And I think a lot of what this movie is talking about is class and the way that drag isn't just necessarily impersonating the opposite gender, but it's also impersonating to be on Wall Street. One of their categories, they have all these crazy categories that are way outside of, you know, the parameters of like, you know, big hair and fake boobs.
Mm-hmm.
There's a category for look like a college student.
Be able to blend in completely. Yeah. That was interesting.
Realness and all of these ideas of not only dressing in drag to be as feminine as possible, to blend as a woman, because, you know, a lot of these characters are actually transgender and they don't use that word because it wasn't really in the vernacular at the time.
Sure.
And you can tell even like within that group, even though they kind of see them all as a family and as part of the same thing, there's actually a lot of diversity into, you know, types of queerness going on there. There's also realness, not just to pass as a woman, but also to pass as straight.
Right.
There's a lot of this, you know, kind of macho realness going on where people are dressing as like military soldiers. So it's all about a culture that identifies totally with being outside of the mainstream, but desperately want to be part of it and have turned their desperation into performance. And that I think is endlessly fascinating. On top of the fact that you have great documentary subjects, Pepper LaBeija for days. I could watch her read the phone book. Pepper LaBeija or Willie Ninja, who actually did the first voguing song that was produced by Malcolm McLaren, who used to produce the Sex Pistols, or he used to manage the Sex Pistols, and then Madonna ripped it off with Vogue. But those are great documentary subjects, and just to kind of watch them sort of express themselves and tell the story from their eyes. And one of the things I always complain about modern documentaries are sort of post A&E, post History Channel documentaries, is now you have the talking heads, right?
Sure.
Where you bring on the experts to kind of come in, or you have, you know, Michael Moore's kind of style where you have the guy who sort of leads you through everything. Jenny Livingston takes herself completely out of the documentary. Her stuff is purely presenting it as is. She lets them tell their story.
Hmm.
And I think that it's a stronger documentary because of that. And she, it's edited very well and very economically, and it never feels like it's going off on a tangent or anything like that. And it always comes back to the main themes, and God knows, you know, she spent five or six years shooting this thing. She probably could have made a 60-hour documentary on the subject, but instead, you know, this 111-minute version, it, you know, burns pretty hot.
Mm-hmm.
So I've seen the movie probably 6 or 7 times. One of the reasons I recommended it, is because of where I work now, we play like this, like funk R&B channel all day.
Okay.
And they play that, What Is Real song or whatever that they play in the movie. And all I could think about was Paris Is Burning, so I had to watch it again.
Oh, no, that's fair. No, it's fun. And like I said, to me, this is about the same as Burning Florida. These characters are just as colorful and just as interesting. Those worlds are parallel to me. I just like being a fly on the wall.
Right. And that's what the movie's doing with you. Mm-hmm. They're letting you be that fly on the wall in a culture that you might not necessarily be a part of.
Well,
or you might.
At a time period, too. I think that's an interesting thing looking at it now versus, you know, when it came out.
Right. Because this is like smack dab in the middle of the AIDS crisis, smack dab at the end, you know, from the passing of the torch from Reagan to Bush.
Mm-hmm.
You know, time period wise, for this culture in particular, that's a very volatile time period.
Right. And a lot of these people faced, you know, violence from people in the streets a lot. And I'm not saying that that still doesn't happen, but what I'm saying is it was a much more volatile time period, like you were saying. I very much enjoyed it.
There's a really heartbreaking scene I always think of when they talk to like they look like 11, 12 years old. These kids, you're just like, yeah, I don't have a mom.
Yeah.
I don't have a dad.
Those ones, yeah, that one was, those were heartbreaking. I was also, I guess I was a little, their age and to be hanging out on the streets and all of that kind of stuff was all very scary for me.
Right.
Like, we need to find you a home immediately. So I felt sort of strange about that. I still don't. I'm
very
unsure.
Protective.
Yeah.
You kind of became Mother Bear at a moment.
Yeah, I was Mother Bear. It happens more and more frequently as I get older. So
right. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, there's the movie does a lot of things tonally that I think is very unique. Obviously, there's a level of camp that's kind of played up on purpose. And in sort of a very knowing, ironic way. But there's also, and it allows itself for a lot of levity and, you know, very funny. And these characters are very entertaining, but it also has something to say and it's very political at its heart.
Well, the economy, that part of it really is probably like maybe the key to it.
Yes.
It does get very kind of like all they want is like what? I don't know. It kind of shows you the mindset, though, kind of going into that early 90s. And when we think of things like Wolf on Wall Street, even though this is a subculture and a minority, I don't think it was that much different from a lot of people at that time period. I think it kind of captures a thought process that happened to a lot of people during that time period. Everybody wanted to be on Dynasty at that point. There was a wealth worship going on. Again, to me, it's interesting to see in from our time period now to what it was then, because lots of things have changed, but are still kind of the same in some respects. So,
right. And historically, this was a big mover and shaker of the early new queer cinema. Thing that kind of happened. This film and Todd Haynes' Poison was released in the same Sundance year, and both of those films are kind of seen as what kind of kickstarted the 90s new queer cinema explosion, and then it really got started in 92.
Was this one of the films that you were really, because I know at some point during film school this was something that you were kind of looking at, the new queer period of time. Is this one of the films that you're really looking at?
Sure. I mean, when I watched a lot of those movies, I've watched Poison. I watched this. I watched Greg Araki's The Living End and The Hours and the Times. And yeah, a lot of those movies from that that time period. And it's a very interesting, just like, I guess, like early French New Wave period. It's just very alive with creativity, and there's a sense of anger and frustration in all of these movies, and a political sense to all of these movies, because, you know, there was a culture of people who were literally fighting for their lives,
right?
And were not being heard. And famously, both Paris is Burning and Poison were funded by the National Endowment for the Arts.
Mm-hmm.
And then that program has since been essentially shut down because these movies were so highly protested, because voters' money were being wasted on these pornography and blah, blah, blah.
Oh, okay.
So there's that. And then if you look at like the IMDb of this, half of these characters, half of these people who were in this movie are no longer alive, because they would die a few years later from AIDS.
Ugh.
Or a lot of other things, street violence and, you know. But that being said, it's incredibly entertaining and very funny.
Agreed.
And not a bummer necessarily all the time.
It has a lot of energy to it. We get into some of the darker elements of it, but that's just because we get into the subtext of the film. The actual film itself is pretty bubbly and energetic, so... Mm-hmm. I think if you like these kind of documentaries, I think you should definitely check it out. I think it's well worth it. So
yeah, what are we going to be watching next week?
So we're going to be watching Prince Avalanche. I had a couple actors I liked in it. Can't remember the names right now.
Paul Rudd and Emil Hirsch.
Yeah, not ready to shift gears yet, I guess. The old brain box isn't going as quick as it used to. let's watch that Prince Avalanche movie. Sounds good.
Yeah, I've been wanting to see it. In fact, it still shows on my Netflix that I watched 16 minutes of it.
No.
So, and it wasn't because it was bad. I turned it off because I was kind of tired and was like, oh, I'll finish it. And then I just never did. So, yeah, this will be a good excuse to watch it again.
Well, I there was a few other movies I had in mind, but I thought I wouldn't subject you to. So Prince Avalanche is a good, I think, in-betweener. And I think it should be funny. And again, I like those two actors. I don't know much about David Gordon Green. Is that who it is?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I got his name right. How did I remember that? Not Emil Hirsch and Prince Rudd.
And Paul Rudd. Yeah, I don't know.
Prince is on my brain.
Yeah, David Gordon Green is... we'll get into it. I could go into the whole David Gordon Green thing, but we'll talk about that next week.
Sounds good.
Okay, so... Yeah, if anybody has any opinions about any of the movies we talked about, The Huntsman, Winter's War, The Darkness, Paris is Burning, or Prince Avalanche, go ahead, or any of the news items we talked about, or you just have a bone to pick with something we said in this episode or other episodes in the past, you can email us at jabberinthedrone@gmail.com. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/jabberpodcast. You can follow us on Twitter @jabberpodcast. Subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Player.fm, Pocket Cast, Zune, and the Windows Podcast Network. And you can also find our regular archives at jabberinthedrone.podbean.com. You can read the movie reviews that I do for the Idaho State Journal at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com. I'm going to be doing a few more reviews. The Seattle International Film Festival just started, and MacGuffin has just put out a big list of screeners they're handing out to their writers. So I'm going to grab a couple of those and do a couple of reviews for them at mcguff.in/author. mcguff.in/author/Cassidy. Be sure to check out Brad's lit zine blog. I never know what to call this thing. Literary journal, film,
his comic website book thing. That talks about film and stuff and yes, comics. Sounds good.
panelandframe.com. And be sure to listen to all of the podcasts that we recommend and have participated in to some degree or another. Leland over at dampercast.com. Rod and Denise over at their Southern California podcast. They just did their episode 200, and it was a two-parter. My submission was in part two, which I think comes out this week, Tuesday, and that is The Listening Party. And go ahead and check out our friend who writes into the show often, and if you listen as often as he does, you should write in as well, Patrick, over at Make Dad Read Comics and Almost Educational. That's all we have for you this week. We'll talk to you next week.
Have a good one. Bye.
Bye.